I'm Rachel Otwell, arts reporter for WUIS, and today we have a real treat for history and theater buffs alike. This is a new one-man, one-act play written by Ken Bradbury. It's called The Last Full Measure, and it explores what President Abraham Lincoln's thoughts may have been in the moments after he was assassinated. World-renowned Lincoln actor Fritz Klein will be playing the role, and it was directed by Phil Funkenbusch. Funkenbusch, Klein, and Bradbury all participated in a discussion panel, which will follow up the play. Stay tuned and enjoy.
I am the tallest gunner, the slickest dancer, and generally the loudest critter in the state of Vermont.
Augusta, dear, to your room. Yes, Ma, the nasty beast. I am aware, Mr. Trenchard, you are not used to the manners of good society.
Don't know the manners of good society, eh? Well, I guess I know enough to turn you inside out, old gal, you sockdologizing old man-trap.
Mary? Mary? I'm confused. I must try to recall. What's that? Something's happened. The noise! We have tickets to the theater. Grover's Theater. But I prefer Our American Cousin at the Fort. That's what she said. Whatever you wish, Mother. Breakfast. Robert talked of his recent tour with the Army. I had coffee. Read the paper, I had an egg, I listened. I visited with Colfax. Take this message to the Ford. We want the state box for tonight. The Grants were coming with us. Yes. Oh, the cabinet meeting. Yes, I remember that. Reconstruction. Stanton was late. Grant talked of Appomattox. Oh, it's the ruckus. What's going on? You don't hear me. Hey there. You don't see me. Grant couldn't come. What? I must try to remember. Stanton. Stanton sent his regrets. No one wanted to see that play. We came out. The White House porch. That soldier had one arm. He shouted, "I would almost give my other hand if I could shake that of Abraham Lincoln." I shook his hand. Mary, where's Mary? We entered the carriage, rode to Navy Yard. I remember that most pleasant evening. At supper, Mary said, Major Rathbone and Clara Harris would see the play with us. Yes, we were late. Always late. The band stuck up. Oh, it was cold. I remember that cold. She said, "Do you want a shawl?" "No, no, I'll just put on my black." I'll just take this coat. Cold. So very cold. The lights are ablaze at the Peterson house. Something's wrong. Badly wrong. What? What is it? Dear God. Dear God. The wink of an eye. The draft of a breath from the blossom of health to the paleness of... Mary. I can't. What was it? She turned to me. I was holding her hand. She said, "What will Miss Harris think of my holding on to you so?" I said, "She won't think anything about it." And that was that. Hardly a eulogy. Cold. So very cold. The vigil goes on. The leaves of the oak and the willow will fade, be scattered around and together be laid. And the young and the old and the low and the high shall molder to dust and together shall lie. Is this how it ends? Stanton. Wells. Quite a gathering. Physicians. Robert! Robert, I'm... So this is the nature of things? Peculiar circumstance. Almost comic. My loved one scurry to find the assassin. And the cure, and I care nothing for either. I simply want to know. I want to know what will remain. What will be left? So the multitude goes. Like the flower or the weed that withers away to let others succeed? I hope so. I've been here before. It was a dream sometime past, but the memory of that dream remains. There was a death-like stillness about me. And then I heard subdued sobs, as if a number of people were weeping. I thought I left my bed and wandered downstairs, more sobbing. I went from room to room, a light in every room, but no living person in sight. Then I entered the east room and saw the corpse wrapped in funeral vestments. Guards stood by, and a throng of people gazing mournfully upon the corpse. Its face was covered. I demanded, "Who is dead in the White House?" A soldier turned to me. "The president." I slept no more that night. I had not anticipated this time of waiting, this strange interlude. Between what? Oh, Willie's funeral was in the East Room. Oh, Mary! I've always relied heavily upon the good advice of others. I've not always agreed with him, but looking at a problem from all sides, well, that's the only way to see around the corner. But tonight, I seem to be short of company, short of advice. So, I wonder. I wonder how others might advise me this evening. I seem to have been given these few brief moments. Billy, what do I do? You are my law partner. We've known each other since we were young men, discussing poetry and politics in Springfield. Billy never minces words. He uses a great many, but they were never minced. What you have me do, Billy? You research matters thoroughly, and you are my man among all others on the globe. Well, I don't see any way out of this one, Billy. My friend, I don't think there's any getting around my situation this time. No, don't shout so. There's a convocation going on next door, and they're plenty taken up with their own problems. Just give me some advice. I've never been in this corner before. You think that'll work? You want to appeal my case? Billy, I'm about to go before the chief magistrate. Who's there left to appeal to? Well, the jury, yes. That's where I've been the most successful, I suppose. Gentlemen, ladies, I think I'll take the case of the defense, Billy. I'm better prepared to argue in that direction. My fellow citizens, the defendant before you tonight stands accused of multiple offenses. He was often slow to react. We agree. And in his defense, he pled a need for caution. He is accused of too often neglecting his family. He does not deny that fact, but asks for a bit of mercy and contends that the devotion of his loving wife more than made up for his negligence. Some have accused him of not taking the cause of abolition to a greater plateau. To that, he simply pleads understanding on your part, hoping that you will believe as he did that he could only toil in the field of what was possible, the cause of union taking all the available passion that his nation had to give. Good. Enough, Mr. Herndon? I know. I should have summoned witnesses. But they're all in the jury box tonight. Huh? Oh, well, there is one passage in the play of Hamlet, which is very apt to be slurred over by the actor or omitted altogether. But it seems to me to be the choicest part of the play. It is the soliloquy of the king after the murder. Oh, it always struck me as one of the finest touches of human nature in the world. What if this cursed hand were thicker than itself with brother's blood? Is there not rain enough in the sweet heavens to wash it? Wait, there's snow? I hope there is, Billy. I most sincerely hope there is. Methinks I could not die anywhere so contented as in the king's company, his cause being just and his quarrel honorable. That's from Henry V, Billy. But if his cause be not good, the king himself hath a heavy reckoning to make when all those legs and arms and heads chopped off in the battle shall join together at the latter day and cry, "All, we died at such a place." Some swearing, some calling upon a surgeon, some for their wives. Left poor behind them. Now, if these men did not die well, it will be a black matter for the king that led them to it. Billy, I sat there at the telegraph office and read the reports from the first battle at Bull Run. Towards 1,000 killed, thousands more wounded, an unprepared army led to war by an incompetent general on the urging of an uncertain commander-in-chief. Is there not rain enough in the sweet heavens to wash it white as snow?
Sorry, Billy. I wouldn't put your money on a successful appeal.
Oh, I hold your advice, dear, my friend. I'd go to you to see the far side of an issue. You've spent a good deal of time over there. You know the territory. In fact, you kept me from traveling there myself. It's you. Speed. Joshua Speed. Oh, yeah. I'm in a predicament. What do you advise?
I know.
I know. Listen, Speed. Listen. You gave me more than a home in that rented apartment above your store. More than a home. You gave me your lifelong friendship. Now, what would you advise? I've always depended upon you for the voice of reason, my friend. And now I could use some calm counsel. Billy thinks I should appeal my case. What about you? No, sir. No, you have not let me down. No, sir. Please, don't talk like that. I suppose every man can use a shoulder to cry upon, and we've always had each other. That was the hand of fate, Speed. You couldn't help that. I remember. I will remember when your father, the judge, died. Did I tell you, did I ever tell you how your moving back to Kentucky affected me? I had just broken my engagement with Mary, and to lose both you and her in days, well... It's fine, Joshua. It's fine. There's counsel enough in your tears, my friend. There's a sweet wisdom that comes with sorrow. I cherish your tears, my old friend. Oh, there you are, Mother.
Oh. They've asked you to leave the room, haven't they? I wonder who got that fearsome task.
Oh, you are my love. But I'm afraid composure has never been your strong suit. Oh, somebody take care of Mary. She's sitting there alone. Somebody be with Mary. You will, won't you, Tad? Wiggling like a tadpole the day you were born, and you've never stopped wiggling. How many White House teachers did you run through? Your string of disappearing tutors nearly beat my record of retreating generals. If I recall rightly, you're watching a play about Aladdin tonight, aren't you? I hope the news hasn't reached you yet. What advice would you give Papa Teddy? Oh. Attack? Yes, you would. You would advise a headlong assault upon the enemy, wouldn't you? I'm afraid my opponent tonight has never suffered defeat, Dad. Take care of her, Tad. Comfort your mother. Oh, there'll be no consoling in the days ahead. But after that, love your mother, Tad. Up to you, last, Stephen. No. Isn't it mystifying, perhaps even sublime, that my final thoughts turn to my old rival, Stephen Douglas? Oh, there is much to admire in you, my dear departed friend. In fact, I once envied you. Perhaps now more than ever, considering my current state.
Yes, once again, you have bested me.
Through all the debates and elections and squabbles, I never doubted your dedication to the cause of union, my friend. Never. In fact, as I sit here tonight watching the crowds enter my death chamber across the street, I fear that perhaps history may somehow overlook what you have given to our nation, and in the final days, our cause.
No. I think I'll not ask your advice. I already know it. And I apologize that in this, our final conversation, I give you no chance for rebuttal. You would advise me to look back upon what we have accomplished. And you'd say to me, stop being that morose old Lincoln who kept every heartache so deeply hidden. And then you'd, being Douglas, go on and say much, much more. My dear old friend, the debate has come to its end. Jack? Kelso? Now that is curious. The president lies dying in a boarding house, surrounded by the great powers of his day. And he thinks of Jack Kelso, a ne'er-do-well drifter in New Salem, Illinois. I haven't thought of old Kelso in... Oh, Jack was my first and best mentor at fishing. He was a master builder, skilled farmer, the best woodsman in Illinois, and he chose to do none of those things. He wanted to fish, that's all, just fish. Jack had passion. He told me, there's no one so dead as a man without passion. If Jack's passion was hooking the biggest catfish in the Sangamon River, then he counted his life full and well-lived. He had other passions, too, none of which earned him a nickel. Shakespeare was his passion, and Robert Burns. He told me any fool can make a living, Abraham, but do they have passion? That's what gives breath to a man. You know, Burns wrote of that passion, Jack. He said, by oppressions, woes, and pains, by your sons in servile chains, we will drain our dearest veins, but they shall be free. Lay the proud usurpers low. Tyrants fall in every foe. Liberties in every blow. Let us do or die. Jack. Disappeared without a trace. But perhaps you knew the better way after all. Nobody remembered you for what you did. But no one will forget who you were. How did I do? Did I have passion? Abraham Lincoln, born February 12th, 1809, in Hardin County, Kentucky. Education, defective. Profession, a lawyer. Have been a captain of volunteers in the Black Hawk War. Postmaster in a very small office. 4 times a member of the Illinois legislature. And was a member of the lower house of Congress. 2 times elected president of the United States. What do you think, Jack? How did he rate? Did you find passion in any of that? Some dared call it ambition, but I like your word better. I was illiterate. I had a passion to learn. I was born as nothing. I had a passion to become something. And then our passions mature. We see injustice. New passions arise. We see war. We become passionate for peace. Oh, I hope I might be remembered for my passion. Oh, the crowd is growing. The boys of the press have arrived. Not a good sign for any president, living or... But if those passions, if a man's passions are not carried out, if others fail to take up the torch, what remains? What was his purpose in being? The war is won. But that is not the end of the thing. The question yet remains whether any nation so conceived, so dedicated, can long endure. It is for us, the living. If the dreamer dies, what remains? Who will carry it onward? Sometimes I think I have learned precious little in this city, in this job. Thing I know, that this thing conceived in liberty, the proposition that all men are created equal, it is fragile. It is not everlasting unless we make it so, unless we keep making it so again and again and again. With the rising of each day's sun. And that... As I look, the anxious faces in the street are quickly turned to those of mourners. And that is my fear. The sun is rising. Oh, my dear friends, do not fear for me. It is I who fear for you. I did not conceive this democracy. Far wiser minds than my own gave birth to that noble idea. I only held it for a while. It now belongs to you. Have you the passion to sustain so precious a gift? Oh.
Oh, I have sometimes been unduly flattered with the title of courageous. For the most courageous thing I have ever done is to give a case into the hands of a jury. And that, my friends, is what I now give to you. A good lawyer pleads his case as best he can. And then, well, then the judgment is left for someone else. Oh, the voice of the press running away from the buildings, scurrying away with that story they've awaited this long night. Some will get it right. Some will miss the mark. And what is left? They'll call history. Brings no warmth to the morning. I'm so cold. Someone she to marry. Please. Someone. For me. We wanted to travel, didn't we, Mother? When all this was over and we could go home, I wanted to see the birthplace of Shakespeare, Burns, maybe tap into a bit of their inspiration. And now, it seems as if there is but one journey left for you and I. Oh, why should the spirit of mortal be proud? Like a swift, fleeting meteor, a fast-flying cloud, a flash of the lightning, a break of the wave, he passeth from life to his rest in the grave. Huh, this little book, a daily treasure, a gift from you. Today is April 15th. Far from the paths of men to thee, I solemnly retire. See thou who dost in secret see, and grant my heart's desire. Take me home. Please. Up.
I'm Rachel Atwell. You've been listening to a performance taped in the Sugg Studio here at WUIS. This play is called The Last Full Measure and explored a fictionalized version of what thoughts were swimming in Lincoln's head following his assassination. The actor, director, and playwright joined me and the audience for this discussion.
My name is Fritz Klein. I live in Springfield, Illinois, and I was the actor in this play.
My name is Ken Bradbury, and I was the author.
I'm Phil Funkenbusch. I work at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Museum, and I'm the director.
I might get the ball rolling if that's okay. I don't have a lot in common with Abe Lincoln or Springfield, but not a lot of people probably do. However, this theme of death is something we all have to deal with. Mm-hmm. Did that make this incredibly different for you, Fritz, as someone who does Lincoln so often, to have such a intense theme and one that you yourself, you know, really can probably connect to?
Well, the conception of this piece went back a ways. It's not the most historic approach to Lincoln. So some of it was a little squishy. I don't know the right word. As I approached this and when I shared this with Ken, we batted the idea around a while, and my mother, for those of you who don't know, passed away while this play was going on, and she'd been in our care for 5 years. But the magic of theater is it was very easy for me to leave that stuff out the door. And so I wasn't really connecting with real life while I was on stage. But, you know, there were times when my mother was passing on where we knew that she was still hearing. They say that's the last sense to go. Mm-hmm. And you have to wonder, when Lincoln was laying there, was he hearing? What was going on in his mind? And then the play is really built on that whole premise. And I think all of us at some point wonder those things. Either we read stories or we come around a dying situation. And so I think they're great questions.
And Ken, why did you decide to pick this period of Lincoln's end?
Fritz made me. It was his idea originally to do this. And gosh, what hasn't been done with Lincoln? And working with Phil and with the museum, you don't do anything small, or you don't have a trivial pursuit on Abraham Lincoln. I mean, you want it to be important. And two things about Lincoln made it easy. I think he was certainly one of the most introspective presidents we've ever had. Always questioned himself, his motives and so forth. And secondly, he always relied upon friends for advice, both of which we use in the play.
Which actually leads to the question that I had in my mind. The advice from the friends, it seemed to be important in the structure. The order of the friends and which friends he sought advice from. I'm curious about your thinking in structuring that order and which friends he sought advice from.
Well, you know, goodness, we use this method in a lot of social situations. Someone poses a question and we start to cover all the important bases. And then we get to what's more meaningful for us. His first thought was, okay, I'm dying. Who should I consult? Well, my business partner, my good friend. And then, as I think the situation becomes more real for Lincoln, it's, okay, now what really matters? Tad, Mary, my friend who I haven't thought of for years, Jack Kelso. I think that's the way our processes go. That's the way mine do. If you tell me some tragic event hope happened in my hometown tonight, I would first think, oh gosh, what about the town and the buildings and so forth? And then I think, who do I know there? We would tend to personalize an issue.
I always thought it was very interesting watching the performance in the theater at the end when Jack Kelso shows up, because there was this sort of warm feeling in the audience too. And it's like, you know, going back to the beginning, and we all love Jack Kelso, so maybe that's part of that too.
And the neat thing about Jack Kelso is that we don't know much about him. And when he left New Salem, the last I read, there were two people they could not trace, and he was one of them, which makes it, but we do know his character.
It's funny, I thought Kelso is probably the most obscure of the characters that Lincoln relates to in there. And you placed the encounter with Kelso at the end. And often in a conversation of length, it's at the very end that the most important parts come out. And in this play, you use the Kelso character to become the opening of Lincoln's understanding about purpose in life and passion. And Kelso became the key, and it was right at the last character, you know. I thought there was a wonderful irony in that.
That and the fact the worst sin you can commit in theater is to be predictable. And so it's good to, at the end.
This is a question for all of you. I have not seen anything. This is my first experience with this play. And I thought, I found myself trying to realize at which point did he start to believe or understand that he was close to death? I mean, the very beginning was very realistic with how cold he was, and he was in shock, asking questions, trying to reach out. At what point did he realize that I've been shot? Maybe he didn't even realize he'd been shot. At what point did he realize, I'm dying?
Who wants to answer?
You. Because I know we talked about this a lot.
Yeah, we talked about it a lot. One of the difficulties of translating a stage production into an audio production by the seat of your pants, which is kind of how I did it, is those pivotal points that even on stage, we had to be very careful to do things in such a way that the audience would know. And I was worried while I was up there that exactly what you said might happen. The point where it was supposed to be realized was where Lincoln said, "Dear God, dear God." And then he started quoting, you know, "In the wink of an eye, the draft of a breath, from the blossom of health to the paleness of." He realizes then what's happened, but he also realizes he hasn't died yet, that he's watching this. So later in the play, you hear the president lies dying in a boarding house across the street, and when he's talking with Douglas and so on. And then later in the play, he takes a breath, which kind of got lost in this audio recording because the audio came in before I expected it. So I thought, do I take the breath or not? And I was trying to catch up with the audio. So, you know, there's all these dynamics that nobody realizes. But there's a place near the end, right before he put on the coat, where he says, oh, he takes a breath and then he says, oh, the boys of the press are running away from the building. Well, see, in the stage play, that's the first time that Lincoln has, up until then, he's been observing, he's picked a spot out in the audience, and he's seeing all of this activity. And there's chairs on back there where he's sitting down. That's the first time in the play where he realizes what's going out on the street, but his eyes are closed. He's envisioning it. And there's been some heavy breathing and all that sort of thing, and then it kind of calms down. So that's supposed to be the moment of death, and then he sees what's happening, and then there's peace from that point on. But did anybody else have that same question? I hope that didn't get entirely lost.
I watched some rehearsals, and we were concerned about that. And then as I watched the performance with the audience, it absolutely didn't matter.
Sometimes I think when we're rehearsing something, we overthink something, which is my problem, but it makes you also appreciate the word, the written word, the structure of the piece, the poetry of it, and that's why I wanted to do this, because I thought it would be beautiful on just to hear it.
And this is for Ken. So the part about passion really was terrific, and I thought that just uplifted everything. So could you tell me how you came to that and how that developed in your mind?
Well, it was there for two reasons. One, not very historical. It's what I believe, that the passion in a person's life is what makes it go rather than the other adornments. But we also know that much about Jack Kelso. That's about all we know about Jack Kelso. But we do know that he was, by all standards of the day, worthless as far as a help to his wife, but he was a tremendous help to his neighbors. He was passionate. Who else in living in those days would have so much of the poetry of Robert Burns memorized and William Shakespeare memorized? Apparently, man, he was a man who was an artist in his head and had that passion. And so, and of course, I think the idea of passion perfectly fits the idea of Abraham Lincoln. There were times, especially at the height of the war, when that's all he had going for him at times, because the news was no help. It had to be his passion.
Ken, can you tell us, for those who might not be the greatest history buffs of all time, explain who Kelso is exactly and why that was a character who you were able to work with?
Well, gosh, Phil, you live practically next to Kelso.
I love Jack Kelso. Yep. He, you know, one of the great things was I worked at New Salem a lot. I live across the road, and all those people are so real to me now, those characters from history. And the great thing was they did all those interviews. You know, Herndon did all these interviews, and there was so much handed down. And so there's many, many, many of these New Salem people that we know. And he was one of the colorful characters, so he's always going to stick out. But he had, you know, Lincoln talked about him, and he had the passion. He was the real character of the village. And I think I just love the way Ken brought him in when he did as well.
And people who've studied Lincoln's life, which is about 6 million people, can't find anything in Lincoln's early education that had any, he'd have gotten any taste of literature except for Jack Kelso. Lincoln later on quoted Shakespeare so freely and quoted Burns, didn't it? Because we do know that Kelso was schooled in both of those fellows.
I really love the surreal music and the way that you've stretched this really intense moment. You know, good theater, good plays, good storytelling is about the moment. Mm-hmm. And this is a very long, tense moment that seems to stretch and blur time. Mm-hmm. So really one question, but I'd like to hear two different answers, because I'm sure, Phil, your pressure as a director, how do you help the actor to get into that space and maintain that intense, you know, struggle for that long? Well, and then I'd like to hear what Fritz has to say. What did you do as an actor to get to that space? And because it's very intense, you're crying on and off throughout the play. So how does a director pull the actor into it?
I always worry that it's going to be, you know, go overboard. And so I was always saying, cool it. But the thing is, Fritz has really good instincts, and the script is so fine that it just happened. It just worked itself out. I mean, we rehearsed a lot. Mainly it was the instincts, and that's what it was all about, is for the instincts of the actor.
I was helped tremendously by the playwright, who gave me the big picture that the three essential portions of the play were Lincoln struggling, the disorientation in the beginning, and then beginning to search for some way to put it together in the middle, and then coming to terms with it. Those are the three basic sections of it. Now, when I was on stage, I wasn't crying the whole time. That's just the way I do audio. And so, you know, it wasn't quite the same visually on stage as
tonight.
I was doing up there. You know, I had my hands around my head. I wasn't paying any attention to what I looked like. I was trying to craft my voice to guide my hearers through a story that they couldn't see by breathing and little gasps and tweaks of the voice, and I hope it sort of worked, but the tears, I'm just one of those, I could have easily been an Italian, you know, I just, it's just who I am, so.
You were very much in your own world, of course, with the eyes closed and everything. Was that the way you acted it, or was that
Oh, no,
tonight?
That wasn't the way I acted it. I just decided ahead of time, I was gonna have to do that because I wasn't playing to a visual audience. I was playing to an audience that could only hear me. And I just found as I rehearsed it for this, that was the only way I could do it, was enclosed in the darkness of myself. And I was afraid that if I opened up and started relating like you do on stage, that that element that was purely auditory would somehow dissipate.
And it's very interesting because the play, before we even were very close into rehearsal, I thought this would be good as an audio book. What you're missing from seeing the play, and we will do it again so you can come see it, but we had absolutely beautiful lighting design.
Oh, yeah.
That put you into the place. And there were some gorgeous, you know, effects that helped that along. And Fritz just took the stage and we mapped out an area for him. And it was just simple, pure and simple. That's what I like.
As that kind of leads to my question, two things, the eyes being closed the whole time or most all of the time as an actor, that I imagine that was difficult to do, to accomplish. But it, to me, it added much to my getting of the play visually, because I would imagine Lincoln not being able to see after being shot. Mm-hmm. And that going through, you know, him, that part of him being cut off, but at the same time, he's the observer. Mm-hmm. And so that must have been a difficult thing for you to do here. The other thing is that I noticed that you kept grabbing your head with your left side of your head. I wondered if that was conscious or unconscious on your part.
Completely
because of
unconscious.
Lincoln being shot.
One time I struck my head for an audio reason, right. so that could be heard. Some of that is just body language that helps me to emote into my voice. I don't know how else to say it. But you're right, the bullet did go in on that side.
I've never seen anything before of this nature where the whole experience was literally an out-of-body experience. And I just have to commend you all for that, because that's exactly what must have happened if there is that consciousness when someone is in that dire strait situation. Mm-hmm. And I know we've all wondered, what's that like? Mm-hmm. And I got a real sense of what that was like in that between here and there point of view. And I attribute it to not only the writing and the director, all three of you. It's just excellent. I really don't have a question. I just wanted to tell you that it was an out-of-body experience watching your out-of-body experience. So there you go.
Thank you.
Well, on that note, thank you guys so much.
Been listening to a performance taped in the Sugg Studio here at WUIS called The Last Full Measure. It was written by Ken Bradbury, performed by Fritz Klein, and directed by Phil Funkenbusch. If you missed part of this performance or the chat we had afterward with those three, head to our website, wuis.org. I'm Rachel Otwell. Thanks for listening.